Suddenly, Bowie is back, but it's Bowie like never before.
She was a young American, all the way from Washington. Her breadwinner begs off the bathroom floor. We live for just these 20 years. Do we have to die for the 50 more?
David Bowie, happening now on his new album, Young Americans, on RCA Records and Tapes.
Hello and welcome back to the Bowie podcast that brings it to you straight and consistently late. It's Album to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. In this edition, we meet a legend of the London music scene, the PR man to the stars, Murray Chalmers, for a chat about that gorgeous piece of post-glam blue-eyed soul, Young Americans. Looking back on it, Young Americans, which came out in 1975 between Diamond Dogs and Station to Station, is a perfect transition point between these two very different albums. It's a gorgeous, soulful album, dripping with R&B and soul, and in it, Bowie captured a fleeting moment of pure emotional beauty. He recorded the bulk of the album in Philadelphia at the Sigma Sound Studios, and there he recruited a smoking lineup of local session talent from the local soul and funk scene, including the debut appearance by Carlos Alomar, who'd go on to be his long-term collaborator and band leader, as well as a local lad, Luther Vandross, who here got his big break doing backup vocals and even contributed a song, which ended up being Fascination. From the shit-kicking exuberance of the title track, through string-sodden, lush, slow jams like Win and Right, up to the minimalist funk strut of Fame, his first US number one, this album's got a slide in its stride and a dip in its hip, and sees the future coming, by which time, of course, our man is, as ever, far off into the distance, making a whole lot of other noises, leaving his rivals scavenging in his wake. So, to talk about this remarkable record, I had to find somebody for whom it was a very big deal indeed. Not only upon its original release, when my guest today was growing up on a Dundee estate, a self-described misfit at school entranced by Bowie, Bolan and Roxy, but still today, when, as the press advisor and confidant of the likes of the Pet Shop Boys, Kate Bush, Yoko Ono and the Lennon Estate, Suede, Robbie Williams and many more, Murray Chalmers still goes back time and again to Young Americans, which soundtracks the highs, lows and emotional blows of his life. Here we are, and in a conversation recorded over a couple of dates, hence the slight shift in audio halfway through, I began by asking this veteran of the pop scene whether he felt that era of the Bowie-like superstar was now over. So here we go, and I hope you enjoy. These days, the music industry has changed almost to the point of unrecognisability from when you first started, in the late 70s, early 80s. Where do you think things are heading for, especially younger artists? Are we going to be seeing big legends like Bowie, Bush and so on coming along in the next few years? Or do you think it's just that era is gone, the era of the rock star is gone?
I think probably very sadly the era of the huge multi-million selling rock star who is also a maverick has probably gone. I would like to be proven wrong. But I think for various reasons, but one of the main things is I don't know whether music touches people in the same way that it did, I hate to say for my generation, but also subsequent generations too.
Yeah.
I think probably for a lot of younger kids now, music is definitely part of their life, but it's maybe not life-changing the way it was for us.
As a teenager growing up in Dundee in the 70s, Bowie kind of crashed into your life. Let's start by telling you about how that happened.
I discovered David Bowie because my cousin, who was very hip and quite a bit older than me, gave me Electric Warrior by T-Rex.
Yes.
That and two Moody Blues albums. And that was almost the first pivotal point of when you had to think, what do I like? Because up till then, I liked Cilla Black.
There's you nothing know, wrong with Cilla Black.
I was young. And funnily enough, yeah. I like a lot of Cilla Black now.
Right.
You know, her early music was very histrionic and dramatic, and the orchestration was great. But anyway, you know, I guess when I was young, I was listening to stuff that, you know, she had a big Saturday night TV show on him. So anyway, Mark Bolan was the first time that I thought, this is for me.
Yeah.
And I became a massive T-Rex fan and joined the fan club. And I was number 10,782 of the fan club.
You remember?
Yeah, because I still have my membership card. Then I discovered David Bowie. And, you know, I grew to, if you had to choose, I grew to prefer David Bowie for a number of reasons. Not least because Mark Bolan went off the boil, so to speak, reasonably quickly. But David Bowie just had everything that I was looking for.
It was certainly the case if you read things that I remember reading Tony Visconti's biography. He pointed out that Bolan basically became unbearable around the time of Tanks. Bolan really, it was just impossible. You couldn't work with him. Whereas Bowie was on the upward trajectory.
Yeah.
Around that time. So, I mean, funnily enough, Bowie was so resentful of Bolan's early success, wasn't he? He was really, really bitter.
Yeah.
He was like, well, God, I want to... But then with Bolan's massive, massive, massive T-Rex mania, he just became unbearable.
Yeah. I mean, he was incredible as an artist. Bowie has, for me, had more longevity, and I think for most other people. And at school, there were a little coterie of hip people. I was very androgynous at school, which is strange because, you know, I'm not now. but I was very androgynous.
I've seen pictures of you.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the art teacher said to me one time, oh, you look like a very beautiful girl, which was a kind of odd thing for an art teacher to say.
It was perfect wasn't it?
Yeah.
Now he's a number.
I'm sure now he might be probably thinking before he says it. Yeah. But anyway, there was a kind of hip, very small coterie of people at school, Harris Academy, and they were into David Bowie and Roxy Music. And in those days, when you got an album, for some reason, you would take it into school and carry it under your arm and walk around all day with it. Really, ostensibly, it's because you were going to lend it to your mates. But a lot of it was, look what I've got. Yeah. And I did it, of course, yeah. And I wasn't really, at first, I wasn't part of that coterie because I was kind of on my own. But then I joined it, and somebody who was part of it had David Bowie's address in Haddon Hall in Beckenham. And we all wrote to him, and because we were absolutely crazy about him.
So and this must have been, what, early 70s?
Yeah, this was, I think, 72.
Around
72 or 73, yeah,
right,
about then. And we all wrote to him, and, you know, we were music obsessives. And in those days, people would play Dundee, you know, big artists would come, and you would go and see everyone. That even it didn't matter if you didn't really like them, it's just, oh, wow, you know, Paul McCartney's coming to town, you know, everyone. So anyway, I very quickly, Bowie was my thing, and... it wasn't. I mean, it's become such a cliche now, that Top of the Pops thing, when people say, I watched it and my life changed. And that didn't happen to me. And it's not me being saying I was there before that, but I was already into him. But of course, that was great. But, you know, the Old Grey Whistle Test performances were great, too. I mean, he was David Bowie. It wasn't just one moment.
Right.
Funny enough, I think a lot of straight guys always quote that moment, interestingly. For me...
Do you mean that's all the Pops moment?
Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, it was mainstream. I mean, Old Grey Whistle Test was a bit more niche, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He'd be there with Bob Harris in his
Saturday
night.
But
he looks amazing. He's got the big red boots on, the jumpsuit. But I think that Top of Pops moment, that's a good point you make. A lot of straight blokes will refer to that as being, oh, my God, that's the first time I saw anything transgressive.
Yeah, and I think, of course, that's good. And, of course, it's completely what happened to a lot of people. I just loved him. There wasn't a single thing about him that I didn't love. And I thought about him so much. And, you know, because I think when you live in a very small place, which Dundee was, and if you feel at all different, which I did, you know, David Bowie was a lifeline. And punk became a lifeline too, in a different way. But of course, you know, punk were the children of Bowie anyway.
Right,
so,
exactly.
Well, the kind of punk that I like.
The album that you've asked to talk about today is sort of neither of those. I mean, it's not the punk of Bowie or the punk of the movement of the late 70s. You've chosen the very stylish, slick, smooth, Philly soul inflected Young Americans from 75.
It's my favourite. I mean, if you have to choose a favorite, I think for me, for 7 or 8 years, everything he produced was monumental, and I can't think of anyone else who's done that. I just can't. And you know, some years he produced 2 albums in a year, and the work ethic was unbelievable, and each one changed a whole generation, pretty much. The anticipation and the change in the way you looked and the way you thought, and, you know, you discovered William Burroughs and Jean Genet and all these people, Andy Warhol. But yeah, I've chosen Young Americans because, for me, often has the most resonance. And it's interesting because he called it disingenuously plastic soul, and I always got irritated by that. I can see why someone would do that, but to me it's not plastic, and I think it's very real. I mean, I don't know, but
and
maybe
he also was going to call it the Gouster, shilling the rubes. And again, the implication here being that, like, you know, come on, I can't be totally sincere about this. There's a layer of separation between me. And,
In life that works often too. It's a very good way of protecting yourself by getting in there first.
Exactly.
Any criticism.
And he was always kind of doing that.
Yeah, I mean, he was very clever with perception and things like that. But ironically, I think it's the. I play all the albums to death up till. Heroes was probably my departure point, and then I dipped in after that. But Young Americans is the one I play all the time, and especially two tracks, Win and Write, and especially Win, which is my favourite David Bowie song ever. It's the second track.
It starts with that heavenly, gorgeous David Sanborn's sex, just blah.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. And amazingly, I'm having goosebumps now just when you were doing that thing about the sax. It means a lot to me for many reasons. I think it's a beautiful song. I think it expresses being a certain kind of being in love really well, the kind of wistfulness and hunger and hurting. So I guess you might say some negative things about being in love, but it's a very romantic song.
True, it really is. On the surface, it sounds wonderful and smooth, and yeah, you think it's a fairly straightforward love song, but when you get into the lyrics here, me, I hope I'm crazy. That's the opening line.
Yeah.
And then he goes into this series of half steps. You're right, it is very much about the madness and the mental disarray of experience of fan love and worrying about it. Someone like you should not be allowed to start any fires.
Yeah, that's an incredible
gorgeous line.
I love it, and I always have loved it, but as I've got older, I'm 59 now, and you know, this is an age when you go through a lot of changes, or I'm finding that anyway, in the way that you think, in the way that you want to approach life and stuff. Yeah, last summer when I was getting ready to leave London, and I was in a relationship that was very difficult but exciting. And it involved a lot of kind of clandestine meetings and stuff. It's, you know, it was a mindfuck. And Wynn was my soundtrack. And it was my soundtrack on the days when I was feeling absolutely euphoric and in love with life. But it was also my soundtrack on the days when I was thinking, what the hell am I doing? So that's quite a song.
That is amazing.
I love the original album, and I know that obviously there's bonus tracks and stuff come out, and people love them. With the exception, and this is the biggest cliche, but with the exception of Across the Universe, I think that the album, well, obviously it's not perfect, but it's close to perfection.
In the film Cracked Actor, there's a gorgeous scene at the end of that movie, which is kind of showing the arc from Ziggy Diamond Dogs to the end, where suddenly it's this sort of soul boy in Philly.
Yeah.
Anyway, they're all around the mic, and they're rehearsing that beautiful bridge, you know, taking it, doing it, loving it, one time. And I love, at the very end of this, you see Bowie's face, and he's just got this big smile on his face, and he looks so excited.
Yeah, he looks really elated.
Gimme, yeah, gimme, doing it, taking you with me, loving it, right. Doing it taking right it. Till time, giving it, doing it, giving it,
keeping it back.
I always find it quite funny that I think in his twisted way of thinking, and obviously, I don't know, this is my perception, but, you know, he'd made a soul album, albeit Plastic Soul, as he called it. And, you know, he was on Soul Train and stuff like that. And he was trying to shift his audience to a degree. But actually, the look was weirder than ever. And I always like to think that he probably thought that was his idea of normal.
Yes, exactly.
But of course, you couldn't look more abnormal in a great way. I mean, the album cover was really beautiful. And, you know, the clothes at the time and the cane that he had. Yeah. And obviously, it probably must have been like the nadir of his problems. But it made it a very fascinating period.
He was really in bad shape. I think psychologically, mentally, he was just approaching that absolute, like I said, the nadir, which then propelled him towards Europe.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about, you know, the black magic period, the you know, like drinking his own pee and, you know, sort of like scaring the hell out of journalists and generally just losing it big time. Because I think by this point, his daily cocaine consumption was probably equivalent to the GDP of Colombia. I mean, like, he was shifting vast amounts of stuff up his nostrils. And he always claimed in retrospect, he never celebrated it. He was always rather rueful when he talked about it afterwards, saying, just for anything else, I wish I could remember more of what happened. But he did say, I wanted to keep working.
Yeah.
And when he started on these sessions in Philadelphia, I think as we've touched on quite a few times now, I think there's a slight element of, like, he wanted to prove himself. Because he was working with a bunch of really shit-hot musicians. Mm. And here comes this emaciated, skeletal white boy who wants to play soul. So I think there was this definite edge of, like, you know, I need to prove myself.
And it was a very, for him, it was a very radical thing to do. And I think also not the most cost-effective thing ever to kind of ditch a tour that isn't coming to the UK anyway, but to kind of ditch it, the Diamond Dogs tour, which is very elaborate and costs a lot, and go change it to a much more stripped-down production.
So, hang on, let me see. So he started the tour one way and ended it another way.
Yeah.
And during the course of the tour, so we're talking what, early
I think 74? I'm the most rubbish person with dates and everything, but yeah, I'm pretty sure it was 74.
But can you imagine a major artist doing this now, going out on tour and then changing their identity halfway through and then emerging somewhere else?
Yeah, and with a production that was so huge and whatever, and that seemed to be getting rave reviews. And, I mean, all we fans in Britain were thinking, is it going to come here? Mm-hmm. And I wish I brought it to show you, but I have a letter from him from that period. So I mentioned earlier, me and my friends all wrote letters to Haddon Hall. And
you wrote back?
Yeah. Not immediately. And I'd love to sort of find out how it got to him, because I think, you know, he probably had left Haddon Hall by the time I got the letter. But somehow it got to him, and it's on brown paper. Sounds terrible, but it's very arty sort of to do that. And with the Main Man logo on it.
Right.
So I really cherish it. Unfortunately, I've lost the envelope it came in. And the letter is typed. It's not handwritten. But the contents are very interesting to me, because it's very effusive about, you know, my fandom and, you know, thank you so much for your support and all the things that someone else would probably write, you know, whatever. And but then at one stage he says, you know, I'm on the Diamond Dogs tour. And I can't wait to bring it to Britain.
Right.
And, you know, that's kind of interesting, because it never came here. Somebody wrote in this letter, but he signed it. I can't imagine he sat at a typewriter and typed it, but it might be nice.
Okay, I've got to reply to my father's now.
Who wrote to my older brother, who lives in
Murray's
Dundee.
Murray's been 3 years.
Yeah.
in my sort of memory of this, I don't recall ever hearing him talking about bringing that tour, because the previous year he'd done the Ziggy retirement tour, hadn't he?
Yeah.
So that was July 73, where he'd, you know,
really long tours. Yeah. And Aladdin Sane was a long tour.
Mm.
So I thought it was interesting that someone on his behalf had said that, whether it was going to be mooted or whatever. And then the finishing touch of the letter is he signed it, and it is a genuine signature as far as I can tell.
Love
in green ink.
Yeah.
So green ink on this brown paper and Main Man header. It's quite a thing, actually. I was very thrilled to get it.
So you got that at this very transitional point. So he was on tour.
Yeah.
And I just now, it occurred to me while we're talking about this, July 73, he retired Ziggy. 12 months fast forward, He's a soul boy.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
The speed that this guy was at, I mean, no wonder he was like hoovering up so much gap. I mean, like, he was literally, he'd gone through Ziggy, Aladdin Sane, and was now in Philadelphia being a soul boy.
Yeah. I mean, the sense of exhilaration, all these different things that he introduced everyone to, it was unbelievable. And young Americans, I mean, I don't like the word authentic in music. I can't stand it when like people who like rock music think it's more authentic than pop music or whatever. Right. I think it's, but you know, by his own admission, said it was plastic soul, but it wasn't really, and it was just as much in fact, probably one of the wildest reinventions he could have done. But probably, I don't think it was aimed at the mainstream. But you know, the songs have definitely lasted in a different way to the songs on Diamond Dogs and stuff, which, you know, I find that a lot of the albums, of course, you're in a certain mood and you want to play whatever album. Young Americans is very constant for me because it's very, very song-based. And mostly, I would say, he's not playing a character.
You don't think there's a sort of the Gouster?
Yeah, I think there is.
I always thought there was a degree of a character here because he's there in his zoot suits and, you know, there's this very kind of retro throwback feel to a lot of it as well.
Yeah, the way they're portrayed visually and stuff, definitely. But I think the actual essence of the songs, it's not that they're more song-based, because everything else was too, but they have a sort of enduring, timeless quality, I think, that has made them resonate more for me.
Do you think that's partly to the creative process behind these things? So like we mentioned earlier, a lot of these were cooked up as jams by a really, really good, tight bunch of session musicians in Philadelphia. What was happening around that time? I mean, we were pre-disco around that time, weren't we? I mean, like, as you know, funk was big, soul was...
It was Philly soul Philly and soul. Stuff. And at the time, I mean, obviously I was in Dundee, where it was different.
Dundee soul.
But now, yeah, I mean, Northern soul was Northern huge soul, in Dundee, yeah. Huge.
Were you a Northern soul...
Band. Not really. I liked the music, but I didn't go off to like some. I worked in a factory, and quite a few of the people in the factory, it was pretty soul destroying work. Would go off to Wigan on a Friday night, and you know, but I never did that. I love the music now for sure, but really, I was kind of glam rock and then straight into punk. That was it.
Bypass the soul.
I love soul music, and in fact, like you know, very. Well-known things like Candy Staten, Young Hearts Run Free, and Evelyn Champagne King, Shame, which came out at the height of punk, sort of my favourite records of all time. So I didn't ditch stuff. I didn't think it's just glam rock. I liked everything except for what I thought might be naff, you know, which I always don't like. my definition of naff, anyway.
Do you remember being... sort of like being really into Diamond Dogs and everything. And do you remember when Young Americans came out and being like, wow, what's this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not such a... I would have read the reviews because I got all the music papers and I read them properly. I wasn't really influenced. I mean, I would have bought anything David Bowie did anyway. So I don't read all these biographies where people tell you what the response to it was, but I think it was probably quite perplexed.
Well, I can imagine it was the last minute when the rotting depths of Gotham for Diamond Dogs, and you know, it's all about the chance of the ever circling family, 1984. The next thing is a dancing.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm trying to gauge, is sort of like, as you know, a kid obsessed with Bowie in Dundee, and you're kind of, your mind is in one place, and then another Bowie comes along.
Yeah, but I think if you were into him, I mean, I shouldn't say for the right reasons, because there's no wrong reasons, but if fundamentally you appreciated the fact that he was a chameleon and always changing, albeit sometimes he was just half a step ahead or he was reflecting things that were going on in the world that we didn't know about and stuff, because he was very clever like that. But it didn't shock me at all. I mean, you know, I don't get shocked by things like that. I just saw it as part of the excitement.
Kind of natural.
Yeah, I mean, it's what David Bowie did. And, you know, the fervent anticipation of, you know, you would read that there was a new album and you would go to Boots and you would order it. which for a while seemed like a very strange idea. But of course, now pre-orders are such a big thing, and you know, figures get them bumped up. But you would run to Boots and order it, and you would go in every day and say, is it in yet? Even though you knew it wasn't released yet. And then...
would you do that?
Yeah.
Is it in yet? Is it yet? No, it's next week.
And you would know when it was released, but you would go in all the time, and then finally you would get it. And, you know, you would just gaze at that album cover, and, you know, I just pretty much lived in my bedroom at that time, and just played music over and over again. So no, it didn't shock me. I just thought it added to the picture. And I think as the years have gone by, it's added more.
You mentioned earlier Across the Universe, which always seems to get a kicking from people. I actually quite enjoy this performance. I don't know if you could technically say it's good or bad. I mean, clearly it's not going to be, it's not Heroes, is it? You know, like Lennon always complained he never quite got it there. Then, of course, you've got Phil Spector coming along and doing that gloopy, soupy Let It Be version. But Bowie's version with this sort of like nothing, I kind of quite like that. It echoes the kind of preacher feel at the Coda of Young Americans. You know, at the end of the title track where he's doing that, it's like a revival meeting or something.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I'll try that one now next time I listen to it. Over the years, I've tried many ways of liking it, and I just and now, of course, you can just skip tracks so easily. Yeah. So I skip it. It's, for me, it's not on the album.
Really, it's that bad.
No, I don't hate it.
You're not on the album.
I love things. You know, when something is so pure and you love it so much. And if there's one thing, you know, and before that, you would have to lift the needle up and move it on. But now we don't have to do that. So, yeah, I mean, I would like to love it. Not that it matters, but I would like to love it more. But for me, it's the weak spot.
This is a very Beatley album in some ways. He's quoting, I read the news today, Oh Boy, in the title track. Lennon, of course, is somehow evident on Fame, the final track. I think playing acoustic and doing the Fame at the end. But I read that Bowie's... You know, he was so flattered that Lennon was keen to hang out with him and was interested in him and liked him that he really wanted John to come over and be on the sessions. So there is a theory that he said, hey, if you come over, I'll do a version of Across the Universe. Cannily knowing that Lennon was never happy with that one. It's like how he always said about Strawberry Fields, was that even in 1980, he was giving interviews before he died saying, you know what, Strawberry Fields, I want to have another crack at that. And you imagine George Martin was going,
the song was done
as a sort of like, you know, it's like slightly
ulterior
motive to having this on. And Tony Visconti heard it and he's like, man, what are you doing? You know, we could have had Who Can I Be Now, or we could have had, you know, Saint in the City.
I think it for me, it just doesn't really gel on that album, but it's not the end of the world. And it's funny because we look after Yoko Ono's PR now, and actually the Lennon estate, and I haven't seen her for a while, but when I did used to see a lot of her, I would always be saying to her, you know, so tell me, you know, when you used to hang out with David Bowie, you and John and stuff like that. Because, I mean, she's got great stories, but, I mean, she knew David Bowie very well. And so, but then I always say to her, tell me about Peggy Guggenheim or Jean-Michel Basquiat or David Bowie and stuff, because she knew everyone. Anyways, that's by the by.
But then, moving on, I mean, did you meet Bowie?
I did meet him thanks to Neil Tennant, who, when they did Hello Space Boy at the Brit Awards, my mind goes so much, but it was the Brit Awards, and obviously Neil was a massive fan, and I was in their dressing room, and I just said to Neil, oh, I've never met David Bowie, and actually I wasn't hinting, because I didn't think he would introduce me, and Neil literally just said, follow me, and... took me in and introduced me, and I guess he knew what it would mean because, you know, we talk about Bowie a lot. And so I met him then. And
do you remember that moment when you came face to face?
Yeah, I think I can't really remember what we said. I think I said to him, I like your shoes at one point.
Always a good one.
Because obviously, you know, what you really want to say is you changed my life and you're amazing, but you know, you can't say that. But I mean, he was very gracious considering he must have his days filled with people like me being introduced. But yeah, it was very nice to meet someone who changed your life so much. I mean, I think he and
Susie Sue did that for me.
Yeah.
So it's always nice to let people know that.
And were his shoes actually nice?
Yeah, of course they were, yeah. I think, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, there'll probably be some completists who'll say I've got it wrong, but I'm pretty sure he was wearing the most incredible high heels.
Yes,
yeah.
I don't know, I think, I remember when they did Hello Space Boy, it was the Brits or...
Yeah, it was the Brits, yeah.
Enemy or whatever, and yeah, they did a storming version, and I'm sure he was wearing high heels.
Yeah, he
and
was.
And didn't they do a Placebo duet at that gig as well? I'm sure he did something with Placebo.
Oh, maybe.
Around the same time.
I mean, I focused on PSB because obviously I worked with them.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I met him and it was great. I mean, you can't really talk about David Bowie without getting very wistful because, you know, he's gone. And the later albums were fantastic. And even, sorry, I'm digressing though. But, you know, a lot of people, their accepted wisdom is, oh, he lost it after Scary Monsters. I mean, you know, I don't even love Scary, I like some of it. But the Outside album, I completely love. And, you know, the last few albums that he made were absolutely brilliant. So, inevitably, the way you listen to the music is coloured by the fact that we won't hear any more from him. And I know that for a lot of my friends, who are similar age as me, 60, coming up for 60, it gave them a very strong sense of their own mortality because, you know, he wasn't just a pop star or a rock star. You know, he was... How many people can you say just change your life completely? And he did that. Yeah, the fringes.
You were aware of it.
Yeah, the fringes of it.
You were interning with...
Alan Edwards.
Alan Edwards.
Yeah. So I was living in a squat in Clapham, and I don't think they have squats these days, but...
They really don't have squats in Clapham.
Younger listeners can look it up. Yeah, in Clapham, yeah. So we're 72 Park Hill in Clapham, and it was a very arty squat, but none of us had a job.
Right.
And obviously I was on the dole. And,
so you just come down to London, just
I'd lived in the YMCA, right. You know, in Stockwell, in this little cubicle. At the time, really, it was pretty much me and one Teddy Boy, because at the time, Teddy Boys and punks were arch rivals, and you know, Teddy Boys used to beat punks up and stuff. We were the two alternative people in the YMCA. That everyone else was pretty much students from overseas studying English or whatever. Mm. So they weren't. This was 1978. Because I remember I bought Hong Kong Garden, even though I didn't have a record player. So yeah,
that's loyalty, isn't it? That's depression.
I was living in the YMCA. That wasn't really sustainable because, you know, I'm sure you can imagine how grim it was, and it was this big building on Stockwell Road. And then we had some friends or something who had this squat in Clapham, so I moved there. Mm. Cut a long story short, I was always playing music, and one day, someone in the squat said, oh, you know, you should do music PR. I know someone who's got a company which does that. And he arranged for me to meet this guy who was the partner of Alan Edwards, business partner. And they took me on as a, you know, work experience, as we called it then, intern. That was how I got started in music PR.
So who was he representing?
At the time, they represented... He didn't do David Bowie, actually, because Alan really was linked with David Bowie for so many years afterwards. They did Brian Ferry, I remember, the Rolling Stones / Mick Jagger, Gregory Isaacs, Dead or Alive, It was quite a motley bunch of artists. And incidentally, my trial with Alan was I had to ring up Mick Jagger pretty much the first week I was there. And Alan was listening on the other extension. It was very basic these days. And basically, Gary Crowley, who obviously is the DJ, still, had a program called ESA, a television program. And it was my task to persuade Mick Jagger to do this program because I guess it was maybe not the kind of thing he would normally do. So my trial, my baptism was to call up Mick Jagger. And Jerry Hall answered the phone. I remember thinking, wow, that's Jerry Hall. I was very impressed by that. And I wasn't scared about calling up Mick Jagger because I was a punk.
Yeah.
And at the time, it was very stupid, obviously, but, you know, I didn't really care about the Rolling Stones.
Right.
I mean, of course, I love certain albums now. But I wasn't daunted by it. If I'd had to call John Lydon or Susie or something, I would have been shaking. So Alan was listening on the other line, and then he and Mick Jagger went, yeah, okay, I'll do it. So I came across, like, quite... well, you know, because I managed to get to
persuade him or anything. You just
well, like, I guess okay. I did. I told him about the show, and I suppose at the time it was a hip show and stuff. And of course, he's very savvy. I mean, maybe this is my perception. Maybe he thought, who is this blithering idiot just off the train from Scotland? But anyway, I did it. And I kind of settled in. I used to sign on the dole every second Tuesday, and I still lived in the squat. And so it was a weird existence because, you know, you would, the first time they offered me free records, they gave me records because obviously you're plugging this stuff. And I said to them, how much is it for the records? And you know, Alan was like, no, you get them free, you know, because you're working here.
Oh, wow.
So I was very naive. But I really enjoyed it. I mean, it was working with musicians, which was great. And Alan was friendly with Ava Cherry.
Hmm.
And she just wandered in one day. And I guess they were having lunch or something. I thought Alan was just incredibly glamorous and charismatic. You know, he was very nice with me, and he still is, actually. Very encouraging. I mean, conversely, at the time, I was quite hip without bigging myself up.
Yeah.
But, you know, I lived in a squat. I dressed really, you know, weirdly. And it's what I imagined everybody in the music industry was like until I joined it. And then I thought, no, most of them looked like accountants or something.
most of the middle-aged music executives would have looked fairly staid, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, especially...
like from the 60s, though.
Yeah, yeah, especially when I started seeing people in record companies. And not everyone, but most of them. But anyway, Alan was great. So anyway, Ava Cherry came in, and obviously I thought I did, and then I think I said to Alan's assistant, who is that? And they said, oh, you know, it's Ava Cherry, he's a friend of hers. I suppose it really gelled with me that Alan was very well connected, but I wasn't really bothered about, you know, as I say, Mick Jagger and people, but Ava Cherry I thought was the most exciting thing. And she came in, and I didn't talk to her. And that they went for lunch, and that was kind of it. But for me, it was a very, I mean, some people might say she was a peripheral figure in the whole David Bowie story, but she wasn't. I mean, you know, everyone added something, and obviously she inspired at least one song on Young Americans, probably more.
She was kind of part of the crew that was singing backup on the album.
Yeah.
And you just now mentioned that there was a song about her. I think that's Can You Hear Me?
Yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah, which was written about her.
Which we didn't talk about before, but that's another of the pivotal songs on the album.
Well, let's talk about it now. So, I mean, Can You Hear Me is, again, it's in the mood of Wynn.
Yeah.
You know, it's got that lovely, lush sort of orchestra sound. And what I found was interesting when I was researching for this was that he loved Gamble and Huff, the producers, and that was kind of their trademark, these really beautiful orchestrations and very stately, graceful strings. Do you think that's one of the key songs on the album?
Yeah, for sure. It definitely is. And I think it's interesting when you see, you know, because he did it with Cher. And if anyone hasn't seen it, it's really worth looking at it because he was bombed out of his brain. I don't think his ghost would even come back and sue me for saying that. And the combination of him and Cher singing this very, very beautiful song, you know, very earnestly, but he wasn't really there. He looked incredible, of course, and so did she. But I think all these things just make you realize that fundamentally these songs were really great. And, I mean, I think that I was going to say that this album, one of the rare examples of him singing about love in a very, very open way. But actually, I realized while I was thinking it that you all had things on Space Oddity, like Letter to Hermione and things like that. So I guess when he fell in love, he fell deep. Yeah, I mean, there's no irony and there's no playfulness or whatever.
There's no concept. There's no...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not... I know before we were saying, you know, I feel he's not playing a role on this album. Of course, you said he is, but the songs really aren't. I think the songs are written in a very direct way. And, you know, everyone who falls in love, which is pretty much all of us, I think we'd realise that. They're very tender songs. And I think that, you know, David Bowie had a very strong sense of, it wasn't archness, but, you know, he was very clever. And sometimes the songs really were full of clever things, or you could spot the references, or, you know, William Burroughs and stuff like that. I didn't really do that with Young Americans, and especially these love songs, because I thought they were just very, very tender, heartfelt songs. And I still think that.
Can You Hear Me? Started out, I think, as a song called... I think they tried it out and they called it Take It Right. Yeah, Take It In Right.
Right.
And that's one of my favourite parts of the song.
Yeah.
Is that refrain keeps coming back all the way through. And then you have that beautiful bit at the end where it's just the a cappella.
Yeah.
You know that bit? That's so nice. But I think this song is one of the first cases on the album, on the recording sessions, when we hear from Luther Vandross. Because, of course, Luther Vandross was a really big part of this album.
Yeah.
He was this unknown kid.
Yeah.
This big guy who came in. I think he was a friend of Carlos Alomar's wife,
right,
Robin Clark. And he came in and Bowie heard him. And, well, they do the call and response thing. And it's just amazing.
Yeah. And we spoke before about the lovely clip of Wright.
Yes.
Studio.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's very charming when he just says their names and stuff. I don't know if it is on that clip, actually, but when he just says Luther and whatever, because obviously he became Luther Vandross. And I was a big fan of him and Alexandra Neal and people like that. I used to go to gigs,
really?
You know, where everyone was blowing whistles and stuff. Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought like a hardcore punk would be an Alexandra O'Neill fan, but you have got pretty eclectic tastes.
Yeah, I never thought I did, because there are certain things, you know, I never liked prog rock or whatever.
Yeah,
but I did love soul music and dance music. I mean,
it's funny because when I was coming of age and kind of getting into music, the absolute cheesy outer limits of NAFF were Alexandra O'Neill, Luther Vandross. I mean, I didn't know anything, but I remember around the mid-80s.
Yeah.
I remember when Criticize was a big hit.
Yeah.
And just being like, this is just, oh man, this is so tacky and cheesy. But now it's a bloody good song.
It's a great song.
I'm not familiar with Vandross's solo career.
Oh, I mean, he's great. I mean, there's very, very obvious classics like House Is Not a Home and stuff like that. But if you like his voice, and who wouldn't, then, you know, you should investigate them. But I liked how when he was working with Bowie, as you say, he wasn't the legend that is Luther Vandross. And,
no.
You know, he was a backing singer and, you know, a great one.
He was amazing. But you see him on the Dick Cavett show. They have them doing Footstopping and Young Americans.
Yeah.
And you see him and he's this big guy. But when he opens his mouth, it's just, wow.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure David Bowie probably couldn't believe it that you know he had someone like that doing the backing vocals.
There's a great story about, I think his first interaction was he was up in the control room listening to him doing Young Americans, and he said to someone, "Wow, God, just imagine if at that bit he sings this harmony and then that happens." And Robin Clark said, "Sure, let's give it a go," and they did, and that was it. I want to come on to the next one now, which is in my list, which is not the order on the album, but it leads in beautifully, which is Fascination, which of course was a Luther Vandross song. Funky music is a part of me.
You know, they can get away with singing Show Enough on it, which I think is great.
Show Enough.
Yeah. But no, it's a great song. I mean, every song is really great on this album, apart from the one that we discussed. and that's a great song. It's just, you know. So basically, I think that it's a great mixture of reflection and the euphoria that the best dance music can. You know, and you're right about the strings as well. Sorry, I'm going all over the place. But, you know, 74, probably, all these kind of Philly soul records, and then a lot of them had such beautiful strings and whatever. I mean, I'm not a muso, so I never really used to listen and think, what a wonderful string arrangement. To a degree, I still don't. But, of course, it's such an integral part of the sound.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Definitely with fascination. You just mentioned now it's a song where they actually can't get over singing a show enough.
Yeah.
But what's funny is that when Luther Vandross wrote Funky Music Is a Part of Me, Bowie was very reluctant to sing that lyric.
Right. Because
he didn't feel that he was cool enough to sing funky music. This is coming from Luther Vandross in an interview. And so hence the change to Fascination. And of course, being Bowie, there's a few more layers of meaning get chucked in here.
Yeah.
So you could argue that, I mean, obviously, as we mentioned last time, he was in the grip of a colossal cocaine habit at this point. And some people have pointed out, well, these lyrics, Fascination, She's Got a Hold of Me, everything. It's about his relationship to the drug. But I do find it interesting that he felt, with his commitment to this genre, he still couldn't sing Luther Vandross's lyrics.
And yet, when you see him on television, albeit he probably is on something, I think we can safely say, the sense of abandonment was really huge. And I think from the way that he looked and whatever, I mean, I find these TV appearances completely fascinating.
From this period.
Yeah. Because one, no one either said to him or could get through to him to say, do you think you should stop taking that before you go on, you know, one of the biggest shows on American TV? And I love the, I never know if you call it Cavett or Cavett, but Dick Cavett show, you know, when he's sitting with the cane, and you've seen that.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And
it's on Cracked Actor, isn't it?
Yeah. He really did deliver it all with such conviction, even though you say that maybe inside he had a few doubts. And, you know, we spoke about calling it Plastic Soul and whatever.
I think, that's the same thing, isn't it?
So yeah.
I can't quite bring myself to invest Funky Music as part of me with that same conviction. It's the Plastic Soul thing. Yeah.
I mean, it's funny. I mean, you know, you can't imagine David Bowie would ever be worried about what his audience would think. But, you know, it was quite a radical shift, of course.
It's true, because you think, well, it's David Bowie, and then there's this unknown Vandross, and Bowie very humbly asks Luther Vandross, can I do your song? And Vandross says, what do you mean, can I let you record it? I'm living in the Bronx in a building with an elevator that barely works, and you're asking me to let you record on my song? Bowie's like, yes, please, if that's all right with you. But it's just, it just turns into something so cool. And of course, Vandross is all over it, and it sounds absolutely, it's the one for me on that side of the island.
Yeah, I would love to be privy to see them working together. There is a live album. Have you heard it?
Which one?
It's called Cracked Actor.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it came out on record store.
It's funny because a lot of people don't know about it, even like huge Bowie fans, but it's a really, really great album.
I think it was really limited. It came out on record store day about 2 years back.
Yeah, and you can get it.
Yeah, now you can get it.
Yeah.
I think it's got the Diamond Dogs era photo on the front, you know, you've got the skull and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty good. I mean, I think that's actually better than David Live.
It's much better. There's a brilliant version of Space Oddity, ironically, on this Cracked Actor album. But yeah, I mean, you kind of wonder how much stuff there is and why it hasn't seen the light of day yet, or maybe it will. Somebody up there, somebody likes me.
One of your favourites?
You know, now you've said it, I actually can't think of anything to say about it. So I guess it's not. Maybe you could talk about that.
Well, it's based on a song he wrote for the Astronauts called I Am Divine.
Right.
And he kind of took it, and it's got that great, I think my favourite thing about this is that sort of, somebody up there likes me. You know, that's it. But yeah, it's not a particularly memorable one. It's not one that really, I think it's kind of shoved away kind of halfway through the album.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm afraid I can't think of anything to say about that. It doesn't mean it's not good, but it's never been one that...
It's all right. I mean, there's it does kind of like hark back to these themes that do pop up in his work every now and again about kind of like messianic figures coming predicting doom. And
yeah.
We've had that in his debut album, you know, things like We Are Hungry Men or Space Oddity, or, you know, it comes through again. It's quite interesting to see it pop up here in this sort of soul context. Well, to me, it's, like I said, a fairly... It's okay. It's fine. It's there. I mean, I think the fact that it doesn't provoke a strong response...
I wish I kind of tried to think about it. But actually, no, it just doesn't. But, you know.
I don't think we talked about the title track in much length.
I don't think we did.
I think this is something else that we really must address. Best beginnings to any album.
And it's got everything in it. And it's as an introduction to... Well, the album, but also a new era for him.
Yeah.
It's obviously incredible. And obviously the lyrics are completely amazing.
It's funny because around this time, Bruce Springsteen was fairly unknown. Mm. I think it wasn't that well known. And he would hitchhike up to Philadelphia just to hang out at the studio and try and meet Bowie. And he was giving Bowie songs. I think Bowie actually recorded.
He did. Hard to be a Saint in the City.
And Growing Up. But there is a school of thought that thinks that in... Young Americans, it's kind of Springsteen-esque in the way that Springsteen would like do these little like narratives, right? These little, they're like little films, aren't they? Like the stories, like he drives in behind the bridge, he lays her down, gee, my life's a funny thing, you know, it's like this sort of little story of small town America.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, not a similar subject matter, but it's what he did on Heroes and stuff, obviously, and whatever, these scenarios and stuff. But I think in Young Americans, it's so overwhelming because each couplet introduces something new, and
that's a good point. The couplets, it kind of starts off. So it's in that Life of Mars where you follow this girl through her sunken dreams to the seat with the clearest view, silver screen. It's kind of like that in a sense, isn't it? Because then you have this succession of slightly surreal images. Here, it's sort of there's a context, which is to me, it's very much about America in the 1970s. You know, you're talking about you know, caddies, Nixon,
yeah,
you know, all this kind of stuff. There's a certain, I mean. Around this time, when was Watergate? Was that around August 74?
I think it was 74, yeah.
Right, so
yeah.
Around this time, there's been a slight madness in the air in America with all this stuff going on. I mean, thank God since then, the American presidents have been strong and stable. And,
thank God
for that. Certainly there's never been anyone as bad as Nixon ever since then. And but there must have been a sort of kind of febrile atmosphere. And he touches on race issues, of course, recording in Philadelphia, where that really was a big issue. That must have been a big deal. It's a remarkable song. I mean, it really, you know, it covers everything, you know, like we said, Nixon, Cadillacs. It's got White's got Soul Train.
Yeah.
You know, it's, what's the other line in there? I wrote it down.
I love when it breaks into I Heard the News Today or Bob.
Yeah, well, you've got the Beatles reference.
Really great, yeah.
And then, but that ending when like the singers come in, I think that's what I was just saying now, is that Vandross was visiting and then he heard on Young Americans that he should do that, and then he comes down and he just gets right in there.
Right.
But that, I remember that coda, that sort of like rolling, it's like, like I said last time, it's like a preacher, a revival.
Yeah, that totally makes sense, but yeah.
And then that beautiful, Ain't There One Damn Song.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah. Da, 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 da. And his voice is just absolutely gorgeous.
But he was complaining about the time because he said that he was trying to get these pure, clean tones, but he's doing that much coke that it really... I've got a quote from him here somewhere. My drug problems were playing havoc with my voice, producing a real raspy sound that I fought all the time when I wanted to sing high, swooping into falsettos and things like that. Which is interesting, yeah. Because he has so many vocal acrobatics on this.
Yeah, no, there are. I mean, I just love it when he effortlessly shows what a brilliant singer he is. I mean, not on this album, but Wild as the Wind and things like that. It's sort of, it gives you goosebumps, you know, because his voice is really beautiful.
He's very underrated as a singer, isn't
he?
People don't really identify him as being a great singer, but the expression, and he's one of those, I wouldn't even call him a singer, I'd call him a vocalist. He's somebody who can put so much energy and expression into his voice and really use it as an instrument.
Yeah. It's funny talking about him, isn't it? Because you just think, wow, we really miss him.
Yeah,
you
know, that's what all this is about.
Yeah.
I really miss David Bowie.
There will never be anyone like David Bowie, and you can't really say that about that many people in rock music, or whatever. But yeah, going back to Young Americans, I think I love the Nixon mention, I love it when he mentioned Charlie Manson and stuff in on Diamond Dogs and stuff like that, and it's kind of, because number one, it fixes it to a period which actually a lot of songwriters might think is not good because it's very specific, But I love that he does it sometimes.
A lot of songwriters would reject that and say it's ephemeral, it would date the work.
Yeah, exactly.
But with him, it's placing it here and now.
Yeah.
In this place and this time.
And he doesn't do it very often, so when he does, you really notice it.
It's this idea of, you know, the young, again, I think, you know, his obsession with media. He was always obsessed with media, about perception, how society saw itself. He keeps shouting this, like, young American, I want the young American. What do you think that's all about? Because I mean, I think, do you think he's like referring to that kind of like eternal American dream, like sort of construct, or
maybe? I mean, if you watch Cracked Actor again, I mean, obviously it's very heavily edited, but you know, his fascination with America was really fascinating.
There's a fly in my milk. He's getting all the milk.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff. And the way that, I mean, obviously when he lived in LA, it kind of, it led to his downfall, I guess.
Yeah.
It was certainly a big part of it. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I imagine that someone like that just needs constant stimulation. And, you know, when you live in Britain, you get it in certain ways, but you run out of things, you know.
I think being a foreigner, being somebody like, if he was American, he would want to do it. I think that's always been something that's central to his music.
Yeah.
His general artistic practice, in a sense, like being that alien, the outsider.
Yeah.
And that's what comes across in Cracked Actor.
Yeah, and also he loved, you know, he had a very strong appreciation of glamour, but proper glamour. So, you know, when you see him hanging out with Elizabeth Taylor and stuff like that.
Those photos are mental, aren't they?
Yeah.
They look like they're hanging onto each other.
Yeah.
Do you know the one? I think Terry O'Neill did them.
Yeah.
And they both look absolutely wasted and just...
Yeah. And you can see why he was fascinated by Andy Warhol and stuff, because, as many people became, because, you know, when you live in Britain, that's a very exotic thing to discover. And of course, he was the conduit that made us all pretty much discover all of that kind of stuff.
Do you know what's interesting? Ken Pitt is a very older manager in the 60s.
Yeah.
He was the one that introduced him to Warhol.
Yeah.
Because he came back.
He brought the album, didn't he? Yeah.
Before anyone else had it.
Yeah.
So when you listen to some of those early gigs he was doing, pre-Ziggy, he launches into Wait of My Man. He did a bizarre kind of take on Venus and Furs, I think. One of those 60s singles. It's bizarre. It's like a weird S&M pop hit.
Wow.
And then, yeah, I'll dig it out. I'll send it over to you. There's a track called Silver Tree... God, was it Silver Treetop School for Boys or something?
Right.
Like a really weird, very kinky track. And you think, well, obviously he's not getting on top of Pops. What are you playing at? But he was filtering from that Velvet album from the outset.
Yeah. I think, the idea of glamour... And actually, I think we spoke before about the visuals and stuff. How I think it's quite amusing that he probably thought that it was a bid for mainstream America to come on board.
Mm.
But he looked one of his most freaky looks when he was trying to look normal. You know, I mean, I thought the cover, it looked like it was an attempt to be some kind of very classic Hollywood type image. But I mean, he looked so androgynous and whatever. To me, anyway. So I think it's... he couldn't really look normal. I mean, he did later on in his career, obviously, but that was when a lot of people...
He was about 90 pounds. I mean, he was skeletal at that point. There are pictures of him at the Grammys that year, I think, with John Yoko. And he is... I think there's a quote from Aretha Franklin saying, "I'm too scared to stand next to him." I mean, he looked like a vampire.
Yeah. I mean, he looked otherworldly. Yeah. And, of course, in a pop star, that's always incredible.
I just want to go back to this idea of glamour that you brought up. The cover's an interesting one. The album went through a number of iterations before it got to Young Americans. They were considering titles like Fascination, Dancing, The Gouster, Shilling the Rubes. You know, there was a number of things.
Right.
Apparently there was a cover mocked up, which was him standing in front of a huge American flag in some sort of nylon outfit, holding a cocktail. And I think at the last minute people were like, no, that's really not the case. But this image that we see on the cover, you know, that very evocative... You know, louche.
It's very louche, yeah.
Very louche, with the cigarette smoke curling up. From the previous year, his choreographer, Tony Basil, was photographed for Nightline magazine. And I'll put it up on the podcast page, but if you see the comparison, it is basically a lift off of that.
Right.
And, of course, it's been very heavily airbrushed. And it is really harking back to that golden era.
Yeah, I imagine, like 40s sort of glamour and stuff. And he had a very old-fashioned... glamour. You know, it was such a weird juxtaposition of things and influences and whatever. I think it was very, I mean, it's the cliche about David Bowie that some of the time he just happened to catch on to things quicker than other musicians, or he was more sus to do it, certainly than the public. So he would introduce kind of things that seemed very radical and new, but in fact he'd taken them from somewhere. But, you know, that doesn't bother me because no one else did it.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I think that there were people who started things, and of course the purest thing is normally the best. I don't see anything wrong with adopting ideas. Well, of course there's nothing wrong with it. It's what art's about.
Yeah.
So the fact that people could point the finger at him sometimes and say he didn't invent that, or, you know, Kraftwerk had done it before him or something like that, it never really held any truck with me. I think it's bad if an artist pretends that they invented, actually says, if they don't acknowledge their influences. But he did, and I think with this album.
I don't think he ever laid claim to any particular genre or style, did he?
No.
I mean, I think he was always rather keen to avoid that.
Yeah.
Identified with any one thing.
Yeah.
But if you look back at his career, 10 years before Young Americans, when he was starting out in the 60s, he loved soul. I mean, he was playing R&B.
Completely.
James Brown, artists like that. I mean, it's not like this came out of nowhere. Diamond Dogs, you've got 1984. You've got tracks like that, which have got very definite black, funk, soul influence on them.
So, and the strings again.
That's the strings, on Diamond Dogs.
And 1984.
So it didn't come out of nowhere. But what I find interesting was that he came in 74, started recording Young Americans, and really predated the whole disco boom, certainly in the UK, in the US, as a mainstream thing. It wasn't just in the black music charts, it was mainstream. And he kind of stepped out of it. He did Young Americans, went off to Station, then kind of went down the electronica path.
Yeah.
And then, post-disco, he comes back with Let's Dance.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like he sort of skirts around the whole thing.
Yeah.
Starts the ball rolling, and then comes back to it.
I mean, a really great thing he did was to, it wasn't even reinterpret it, but to redo John, I'm Only Dancing.
Yes.
You know? I mean, that was, and I remember when that came out, we all went mad. Everybody went crazy for it.
It's a great tune. The 12-inch mix of that.
Yeah. It's really incredible. And funnily enough, on that Cracked Actor live album, he introduces it as a new song.
Right.
You know, he says, we're going to do another new song for you now. It's John, I'm Only Dancing. But and I'm sure there's a story, if it's not true, you'll have to wipe it off this, but of when the Banshees were recording something, Steve Severin found the tape of that 1975 John, I'm Only Dancing in the studio and stole it. But then someone noticed it had gone and he had to put it back.
Master tape.
Yeah. I mean, I better check that before you put it out. But I think it's in the Banshees book. But anyway, that 1975 version was really, really fantastic.
And it was great, wasn't it? I think it was meant to be on the album. I don't know why they dropped that.
Yeah.
But it was going to be on the album at some point. I think he felt at one point that, and we'll come on briefly to the Gaust in a second, but the way the album was shaping up with Visconti, it was pretty much a bunch of slow jams. It was like quite mellow. It was all the Can You Hear Me, right? So there wasn't enough movement on it. So I don't know why they lost John, I'm Only Dancing.
It came out later, didn't it? Because I remember we used to go to this club when the Blitz was going. Obviously the Blitz was the one that was really impossible to get into unless you were completely fabulous. And we gave up trying, me and my friends. So we used to go to this rip-off of the Blitz called Studio 21 in 21 Oxford Street.
Right.
But
if you couldn't get into Studio 54 or Blitz, then this is where you went.
Yeah, and amazingly, funny enough, Bananarama used to go to Studio 21 was really great because basically you got people who loved dressing up.
Right.
But they would fall on the floor and whatever, you know, that they weren't as cool probably as everyone who was in the Blitz.
So Blitz was more for like for posing and like serious.
I guess, you know, Blitz was what it was. But Studio, anyway, the John, I'm Only Dancing was really became like the anthem in Studio 21. I think it was run by Jock McDonald, who had some alliance with John Lydon, funny enough, in Studio 21. But anyway, you'd have Bananarama freaking out on the dance floor to John, I'm Only Dancing and stuff. And it was really, I used to love that when maybe people would be taking a break from dancing on one record and let the atmosphere fall.
Yeah.
And then something would come on. I mean, that you, sometimes it would be Fab Gadget, Back to Nature. Or, but John, I'm Only Dancing definitely was the one that everyone propelled on.
You know? That's such a killer groove.
Yeah.
That, isn't it? It's amazing.
Yeah, really great.
The final track on this, the bookend of the album, is, I think, one of the last songs they recorded, which was another collaboration with John Lennon. And there's something weird about it. You can imagine Lennon and David Bowie were quite hesitant around each other first.
Right.
There's a story about Tony Visconti, Lennon, May Pang, and Bowie all hanging out in Bowie's hotel room one night. And this is where, really, when he and Lennon were properly introduced.
Mm.
And they did nothing. They sat there in silence. And then for a few hours, that was it. And then after a while, they start drawing pictures of each other. But Bowie was in awe of Lennon. I mean, he worshipped Lennon.
Yeah, I mean, so did Mark Bolan. I mean,
Did they meet? They never collaborated or anything, did they, Mark Bolan and Lennon?
No. I mean, he mentioned him in at least one song. Yeah.
Well, he worked with Ringo, didn't he?
Yeah.
That would be the day.
To Boogie. Yeah.
But, no, Lennon and Bowie together. And so, again, I think this song certainly started out as just an excuse to get Lennon involved. I mean, Lennon gets a credit on Fame. Mm. I don't really know what he does. I mean, he plays a bit of acoustic. He might have just done a backing here and there. But I think it was more the idea of Fame. And that's interesting from a guy who really has only been superstar famous for, what, two and a half years? Mm. Something like that. I mean, you could take that back to Ziggy. And here he is now. Fame puts you there where things are hollow. Fame, what you need, you have to borrow. It's a really bitter kind of hungover, you know, absolute trashing of pop culture, well, fame culture.
Mm.
Remarkable.
No, completely. And musically, it's absolutely brilliant. Again,
well, musically, it's
I'm not a musician, but I think it's a very sparse kind of sound.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think it's another one that, you know, you know it so well that you kind of forget about it. I mean, now we're talking about it, I think, Christ, it's absolutely amazing. But it is. Yeah.
It's just got that really sparse backbeat. It's got that minimal little guitar, you know. Diddling.
Yeah, that's and of course it. The vocal bit. I mean, I can't sing. You can, but you know when he starts off, goes down. It's absolutely brilliant. Yeah,
I think that seems to be put in subsequently just to try and give it a bit of a dynamic because it is just pretty straight along the line.
Yeah,
nothing much happens. I don't know if this is true. I think Carlos Alomar played on that, and they nicked that lick off a James Brown track, and then James Brown covered it.
So oh, really?
I might as well get the royalty. I might as well get paid for it somehow. But I don't know if that's true. I mean, I'll have to check them out. The thought of James Brown singing Fame is just really weird.
Yeah.
This morning I woke up all in heat. Couldn't find no dry spot from my head down to my feet. Got gasping and coughing till my body began to sweat. Couldn't find no comfort.
It's certainly my favourite David Bowie album. It's very hard to pick. You know, if you have to pick one, it's very difficult during his golden period. But I think, for me, it's the one I always go back to because it resonates the most. And songs that resonate the most on the album are the love songs.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm just a wuss that likes thinking about falling in love a lot. You know, there was a period, obviously, I mean, he would make two albums a year sometimes, and every one would change you. I don't think Young Americans changed me, but it's the one that I like the most, interestingly.
And that's the one that stays with you.
Yeah, I think there's probably not a very, you know, you could say, we spoke about, you know, people saw Ziggy on TV and it changed their life.
Right.
And they thought, oh, you know, such a thing as bisexuality and all that. Because Young Americans didn't introduce me to dance music or whatever. But I just think the songs are really good. And I think it's a very pure album. And I like the fact it hasn't got a raised eyebrow. It's just is what it is.
Perfect. Murray, thank you again. thank you very much.
Thank you.
Funny thing, am I still too young? You kissed her then and there.
She took his ring, she took his babies. It took her minutes, it took her nowhere.
And that was Murray Chalmers talking to me about Young Americans. And if you enjoyed this chat, please do like, subscribe, and review to the podcast and spread the word. It's all very, very much appreciated. So, many thanks to Murray for his time and his insights into the album. Thanks to everyone who's been writing in with their comments and reactions to previous podcasts. And I would like to just say that the next podcast should be out soon. I often do say this in the podcast that it's going to come out very, very soon indeed, and then it doesn't. But I've just spent about 1,000 hours in a studio with the one and only Nicholas Pegg recording the next podcast. In fact, the next few podcasts, I think, given how long we spoke for. And I will endeavour to do my best to get that to you as soon as I can. But until then, remember, keep warm wherever you are, and I shall be with you shortly.